This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We learned more about the tragic events in Dayton, where 9 people were gunned down in a popular entertainment district. The Friday News Review starts now with WYSO webmaster, programming coordinator, and deputy operations manager, Juliet Frumholt. Welcome, Juliet. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
So we learned some new details in a press conference this week. Tell us about them.
Yes, we had several revelations in the ongoing investigation. The week began with some news that federal agents had arrested a friend of the Dayton gunman named Ethan Cawley. He is, the feds say that he provided the Dayton shooter with body armor and other items that were used in the shooting. They're also saying that he stored those items in his Kettering apartment in order to hide them from the shooter's parents. He's not being criminally charged for that, however, because investigators say that the shooter was just as qualified to purchase these items as Ethan Cawley. Instead, federal authorities are opting to charge Cawley with lying about his drug use in order to acquire firearms. Just this week in federal court, they denied Cawley's request to be released from jail while awaiting trial. The judge in that case said that Cawley's alleged drug use and mental health issues made him a danger to others. His attorneys are denying this. We also received some new information about the timeline leading up to the August 4th shooting, as well as some autopsy results on both the shooter and the victims.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Ethan Cawley. How did authorities find their way to him?
From what authorities have revealed so far, he was already under investigation for these firearms charges, and they were able to link him to this to the shooting in Dayton. They haven't given us a lot of specifics on that just yet because it is an ongoing investigation.
Do we know anything about the nature of his friendship or relationship with the gunman?
We don't know a lot yet. There's some initial information in the indictment, which they have released publicly, that the two spent time together, that they were good enough friends for Cawley to feel comfortable storing these materials in his apartment in order to hide them from the shooter's parents. But beyond that, we haven't learned much yet. We're expecting that we'll learn more when the trial gets underway.
At a news conference this week, we also learned some pretty brutal details about the actual shooting and how it happened and how many shots were fired and who was hit by which bullets. Give us an idea of what we learned at that.
So we learned there were kind of two big revelations about how the shooting unfolded. The first was the timeline. We learned more details about the shooter's movements the night of the shooting. Initially, we had just known that he had arrived in the Oregon District with his sibling and a friend 2 hours before the attack, separated from the group at some point, and then reappeared when the shooting began. Now, through surveillance video that's been collated from area businesses, the police have a timeline of his movements from the moment he separated from the group at one bar, him casing the bar in front of which the shooting took place, then going back to his car, getting the weapon and the body armor, and then the route he took to get back to start the shooting. We also found out that he was very familiar with the Oregon District and had been there the night before as well. Additionally, we got autopsy results. Montgomery County Coroner tells us that the shooter had cocaine, Xanax, and alcohol in his system, the levels of which we don't know specifically yet. We expect toxicology reports in 2 to 6 weeks. They are hoping that we get those accelerated, but it, you know, the crime lab does take time. We also learned that two of the people who died that night were also struck by police bullets. Now, in both cases, it was the gunman that fired the fatal shots. One individual received a tissue wound in addition to the fatal shots from the gunman. The other was fatally shot by the gunman, but, and this gets very technical, the wounds that they received from police fire would have been fatal in the absence of the gunman's bullets. That's an important distinction to make there. Police Chief Richard Beale has emphasized that this was a really tough firefight. He likened it in a press conference. He said that, you know, kind of the only time you see firefights like this are in combat or in active shooter situations, and said that it is a very difficult choice for police to make in that moment, whether to shoot or not shoot, and how to, you know, cause as little harm as possible while also eliminating the dangerous element in that moment.
How are they able to make that determination, though, of which bullet was the one that ended the person's life?
They are able to look at path, where the type of bullets, where the bullet entered the body, the type of bleeding, and things like that. We haven't gotten to look at the full coroner's reports yet. We are hoping to have access to that today. One of my colleagues is working on that. So we're hoping to have more details about how they released that determination. But it is all in the science of medical examination that they're able to determine that.
Tell us a little bit more about what they said about the shooter's visit to the Oregon District the night before the deadly shooting. What did he do there?
We don't know a lot about that yet. That is part of the ongoing FBI investigation. Dayton Police Chief Richard Beale said that in a press conference, and then very quickly, in response to the obvious reporter questions of what was he doing the previous night in the Oregon District, the police chief said that he couldn't say any more about that. That is part of the FBI's ongoing investigation. He would only comment that the shooter was very familiar with the Oregon District.
I understand that most or possibly all of the funerals for the victims have taken place, except for those of the shooter and his sibling?
Yes, that's correct. Eight of the other victims have all had funeral services. They began late last week and carried into this week. As for the shooter and his sibling, the family has opted for private services, and we don't have any details on when those will be taking place.
There's talk of a permanent memorial for the victims. Can you tell us anything about it?
Yes, everything is in very early phases, as to be expected. The city has said that they are in the process of forming a committee to determine how to permanently honor those that died in the attack. Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley says that they'll be asking Oregon District business leaders, victims advocates, and other community members to be a part of this committee. She did emphasize that they're only in the very early phases of this project, but that they hope to have more details soon about how this will manifest. People are already saying, will it be a garden or a statue or a mural? It's a bit too early to tell what that's going to look like, but they definitely are thinking about it and will be looking for input from a lot of different facets of the people affected by the shooting.
And we're not even 2 full weeks removed from this tragedy yet. I'm wondering, how is the Oregon District community doing now?
It's mixed. You know, I was out there last weekend, both as a reporter and a community member, and people are both very invested in trying to keep things moving in the Oregon District. You know, the businesses, being small business, they really do have to get back to business in some regard to keep income flowing, to keep paychecks for their employees going and all of that. But it's hard and it's heavy, and there's certainly a tinge of sadness. However, a lot of people are also stepping up. We've seen local musicians out on the street busking very regularly. Last weekend, the streets were packed with people going to the shops and having lunch at the restaurants, just trying to, one person put it really well, kind of bring some good energy to replace a lot of the sadness down there. But it's going to be ongoing. We're seeing a lot of events pop up. Some concerts and festivals that were already happening are being transformed into benefits for both the victims' families and our tornado victims from earlier this spring. So we're seeing the community pull together right now. We will want to see how these businesses are doing ongoing and making sure that the business is sustaining after this, and that people are still coming to the neighborhood and patronizing the businesses and feeling safe and at home in this neighborhood as they had up to this point.
Juliet Fromholt from WYSO, thanks so much for your report today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We turn to Kentucky now. There are growing demands for improvements to the state foster care system after reports of torture and abuse. The Friday News Review continues now with Courier-Journal reporter Deborah Yetter. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah, the CJ explained how this type of coverage was developed. It's really startling reporting. It started 10 years ago when Kentucky led the nation for its rate of child deaths from abuse and neglect. Your paper in Louisville helped identify more than 40 children whose deaths were caused by abuse or neglect. What has happened within the system in that decade since?
Well, sadly, it's only become more overloaded. I've been reporting on this for even before 2009, when we sort of had the unfortunate distinction of becoming the state with the highest rate of child deaths in the nation from abuse or neglect. Now we lead the nation in the rate of abuse and neglect, although the deaths have actually tapered off somewhat. But we decided to go back and take another look at the system just to try to figure out what was going on in Kentucky.
What is going on?
Well, everyone tells me the system is overwhelmed, and in covering this, there is a independent panel of experts that reviews most childhood abuse and neglect deaths or near deaths where a child is seriously injured, and they meet regularly to look at all these cases in a lot of detail. And I started to notice a pattern where it seemed like the abuse was becoming more severe and more violent to the extent that the panel in some cases applies the label of torture. And that's not, just a generic term. It's a clinical finding when a child has been, seriously harmed deliberately or with actions that cause suffering and pain and possibly death. So I went back and tried to figure out the causes. The drug epidemic is one thing you keep hearing over and over. Opioids, methamphetamines, the abuse is more severe and more persistent when parents are totally involved in drugs. But there's also mental health, there's extreme poverty, and there's a lot of family violence. It's a tough knot that the state has been able to untie in decades.
So when you talk about the conditions of the families, whether they're using drugs or what their situation may be, are you talking about the foster families or the natural families of these kids that then force the children into the system?
No. These are the birth families in most cases of children, or there could be relatives or other caregivers they're staying with. Oftentimes, another problem the authorities have identified is what they call serial relationships, where an adult will move around from one relationship to another. And some of the most extreme abuse we saw was where a caregiver not related to the child, maybe a boyfriend who'd moved in with the mother, was the charged as the abuser. The foster system is another story. Once the state steps in and gets a judge to agree to remove the child from the home because of abuse or neglect, then you get into the foster system. And the problem with it is it has a record number of kids in foster care. It reached nearly 10,000 in November because of some of these terrible abuse cases and neglect, but also because of sort of the lack of resources to get in and work with families and try to head off the sort of crisis. So the foster system is a whole different story. It's also pretty overloaded, and workers, they can't keep social workers on the job. The head of the agency describes the social service agency as a revolving door.
When we talk about the foster system in Kentucky, is that a network of systems, organizations, houses, and families?
Yes, The state operates no residential centers of its own, but a lot of private providers, mostly faith-based, have stepped up to do that work. And, for example, it would be Sunrise Services, which used to be Baptist Homes for Children, Home of the Innocents here in Louisville, Mary Hurst. There are a number in Northern Kentucky. Those provide residential treatment for some of the most children with the most severe needs. There's also a vast network of foster families throughout Kentucky, just private families who agree to become, you know, get the background checked and get certified by the state and take foster kids into their homes. About half of those, if I recall correctly, are sponsored by the state of Kentucky, and about another portion of them operate through this network of private providers, like, you know, the Baptist Home for Children's, Presbyterian Child Welfare, et cetera. And they kind of report to them, and then they in turn contract to the state to provide foster homes for these kids.
And so what are the conditions for the children within the system once they're in foster care, whether it be at one of the faith-based organizations or with a private family? Are you seeing some instances of abuse there as well?
Yes, they vary. You have very good homes, which I've heard about, with, you know, families who sign up to do it for, you know, good reasons. They want to help kids, but you also have some issues of children who've described. One of the stories I did was on kids who've aged out of the system and are talking about their experiences now, young adults in their early 20s. And they described homes that were, you know, crowded, neglectful, disappointing. Sometimes parents were, the foster parents were emotionally abusive, calling them, you know, names or belittling them. Other times the placements would disrupt and the children would just get moved along. We did have one case in Hardin County where a 4-year-old was died from a head injury. The foster father was prosecuted but acquitted on a murder charge, and it was kind of his word about what happened because there was no one else home at the time, and the jury declined to find enough evidence to convict him. The coroner had ruled it a homicide, so someone appeared to have banged the kid's head against something.
What is the typical profile of a foster family, the people that take the kids in?
Well, I don't know if there is any typical family. Some groups, Governor Bevin and his wife, who have been advocates of expanding foster system and getting more people to set up foster and adopt, have sort of made a point of urging churches, the faith community, to come forward. And they've hired some advocates who go around and speak at community groups and churches and try to get sort of faith-based folks to step up. And many have. But others may have done it because they see a need. Frankly, I'm told, do it for the money. There's a per diem of about $25 a day per foster child, and it's a way to bring income into the home. So I don't think there is any particular typical profile, but there's a host of them. We're talking several thousand homes, as I recall. I don't have the number right off the top of my head, but there are many out there throughout the state. And some are very admirable. I've been to the events where they honor, like, the Foster Families of the Year, and you have, people who've taken in, you know, dozens or over 100 kids over the years, and they've stayed in touch with them, and they've developed relationships with them. So it just varies.
Does the state need more people to step up?
They could use more foster homes because they have what they acknowledge is too many kids in what they call out-of-home care. In other words, they're in the state's custody, and they have to put them somewhere. But the overriding goal of the commissioner and part of the reforms he's trying to initiate, Eric Clark, is to reduce the number of kids in foster care so they don't need so many foster placements. Ideally, they would like to be able to solve problems for families and correct situations like addiction, you know, violence, assist with poverty before the child is removed, because I think most experts totally agree on this one, that it's very harmful to remove a child from a home, even a terrible or an abusive home. There's a cost for removing a child from his birth family.
Are there restrictions on who can be a foster parent?
Yes, you have to have you have to have stable housing, and you have to show that you've got adequate, you know, facilities to accommodate a child, bedroom and so forth. You have to pass a background check. They do, I think, a fingerprint check these days to make sure there's no criminal record. And they come in and assess your I know the social workers do go in and interview them and do a home inspection and try to get a sense of why they want to do it. I don't know how many people sort of fail the screening process, but there is one.
Can you be single? Can you be in same-sex relationship?
Yes, you can. And in fact, there are a number of same-sex folks who've or what the state looks for is people who want to foster and adopt. You kind of go through the whole training thing. In order, it's also a lengthy training period. I should mention it used to be about 6 months. I think they've tried to streamline it. But there are a number of folks in same-sex relationships, and I've heard some people in the past say that, they are just invaluable in providing more resources, foster resources. And I know some who do it, and I think they've done fairly well. But you can be single, or you can you know, be a married couple. Now, some of the private agencies have their own standards, depending on their faith orientation about how whom they will accept. So, for example, I think Baptist Homes for Children several years ago discouraged a same-sex couple, two men, from becoming foster parents.
You are doing this five-part series on this issue, and in one of the pieces that I got to read and encourage others to read at the Courier Journal, you profiled a couple of people who came through the system. You referenced them loosely earlier. They're in their early 20s, a woman named Cynthia Sheppers and a young man named Christopher Hagens. They both survived this system. They're advocating for reform. Tell us about their experiences and what they're doing now.
Well, Cynthia has a compelling story. She was removed from her parents as a young child, basically raised by her grandmother because her parents were both heavily involved with drugs. And in fact, both died when died when she was three, the other five. And she was removed from her grandmother's care because at some point the grandmother was deemed neglectful. Cynthia wasn't getting to school on time, and they were fairly poor. And her point that she makes whenever she speaks, and she is a very good speaker, is that she was removed from a neglectful home only to get into a neglectful system. You know, she doesn't claim she was terribly abused or anything, but she got into homes where, you know, the adults were indifferent to sometimes what she would describe as outright mean. And instead of being adopted as she'd hoped, she kind of just got moved around from home to home until she turned 18. Christopher, a young man from Lexington, also is a very compelling, and I have to hand it to the state, they're encouraging these folks to speak out and giving them a platform to do it. Christopher has a compelling story, too. He was removed, again, from a home that was neglectful. And his point in speaking to a group I heard, he said that, you know, sometimes families just need some help. He said, my home wasn't terrible. You know, we were poor, and there were some problems, but if we'd gotten the help, I might not have, you know, been cycled through foster care until I turned 18.
And so what is their message to people that they get to talk to? Is it just telling their story, or are there specific reforms that they're asking for?
They are clearly looking for reforms. They want, I think, more help up front so they don't have to be removed in the first place. They would like more effective, if a child must be removed, they would like more effective sort of services aimed at getting the child adopted as soon as possible rather than sort of, you know, spending the rest of their childhood and teenage years in foster care. And that's one thing Governor Bevin is encouraging. Since he became elected, the House passed something called House Bill 1, which is aimed at streamlining the foster and adoptive process and cutting down on some of the delays and making it easier to do this. And the kids are all, you know, in favor of this, but those are the kinds of things they want to see happen. They just would like to see it happen sooner rather than later.
What do we know about the impact that being in the system has on these kids when they go to school, and then when they graduate and they're out in the real world?
Well, it's very difficult for them. Most of the kids know, you know, if a child's a foster child, and kids can be rather cruel. Cynthia, for example, told me when she went to school after her parents died and she was placed in a foster home that, you know, some kids would sort of jeer at her and tell her she was an orphan, which was, you know, hurtful. So, other than that, I think they feel sort of rootless, and they don't have the support system that the normal child and young adult takes for granted. For example, when she started college, you know, she panicked because she couldn't find the building and tried to drop out of her first class building and tried to drop out of school. You know, a normal, you know, a kid from a regular family, a two-parent family or one parent even, probably would have called home and said, what do I do? And she didn't really have that. Or when you have crisis in your life, like you can't make your rent or your car breaks down, there's often no one to turn to. And those are the kind of things that make it so hard for them to do well once they, as they say, age out of the system at 18. They just sort of lack the basic support that so many of us take for granted.
Your reporting includes this analysis of Kentucky that shows how poorly it compares to other states, but other states certainly deal with kids in need of foster support. Are there any examples that Kentucky is turning to or could turn to in other states to improve its lot?
Not so much. That's one thing I found out in talking to folks, that all states are kind of struggling with the same situation of lack of resources, you know, state funding for social services, and an increasing number of kids coming into care. However, there are individual programs and efforts being made to that consultants will point to as kind of bright spots in the system. And a lot of it involves just doing, you know, front-loading services to families and kids to try to solve problems like truancy and drug abuse and poverty and all those things that might propel a child into foster care. Kentucky and many other states are looking toward a new federal law called Family First that takes effect for some states in October, including Kentucky, which allows them to use more of the federal money that they had been allowed only to spend on foster care and shift that to the very things they hope will keep kids out of foster care.
And Deborah, if we could just take a quick peek inside your reporter's notebook, talk about the creation of this five-part series and how you decided to frame it or to separate it into these various pieces.
Well, from years of covering this and in the last 2 years, concentrating more closely on some of these alarmingly serious cases of deaths and injury, I started trying to figure out what would be the best way to highlight what's going on in the system and show people, starting with the level of abuse and neglect that is going on in Kentucky right now, the scope of the problem. And from there, I moved on to specifics like the situation of social workers, for example. They can't keep Kentucky social workers on the job. I told the story through three people I interviewed who had quit just because of caseloads ranging from 80 to 100 when they're only supposed to have 18. I told the story about kids in the foster system through Cynthia and Christopher, the young people who had recently aged out of the system and have pretty compelling stories. I looked at individual cases of children who have died or, you know, been seriously injured. And finally, the last piece that runs Sunday, we looked at some of the things that are working. For example, Jefferson County and in some counties in Kentucky used to have what they called family drug courts, where families that were in trouble, you know, with social services because of drugs or alcohol could get more intensive supervision through this year-long program. Well, that got canceled statewide in 2010 for budget reasons. Kentucky, Louisville, has just launched one, but it was launched solely through a major fundraising drive by the National Council of Jewish Women in Louisville, who decided that was the overriding need in Kentucky was to restore a family drug court. So they now have a family recovery court. I did some reporting on that, who's in it, how it's working, and just how it's helping people get their kids back and get off drugs.
You can read Deborah Yetter's reporting in the Courier-Journal. It's a five-part series, the fifth piece coming up on Sunday. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us and talking to us about it today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Up next, Uber and Lyft may not be on a path to sustainability. The rideshare companies are raising their prices. We'll discuss the unique way they target how much you, specifically you, are willing to spend on a ride. And you could end up paying more at Macy's soon, too. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. President Trump spent part of this week tweeting in an attempt to counter the emerging narrative that the strong U.S. economy may be sailing towards rocky shores. Trump's trade wars and volatile, inconsistent policies are being blamed by some of the country's largest brands, including Macy's. That Cincinnati-based fashion company also saw its stock take a significant hit. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Andy Brownfield. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what did the Macy's CEO have to say about tariffs and what's going on with the company's stocks?
Well, his big takeaway was that Macy's customers just don't have any appetite for price increases. In the three tranches of tariffs that have been imposed so far, Macy's has luckily been able to avoid a majority of price increases, but they had to institute a few in some select areas, and they just didn't go over too well with the shoppers.
I saw that. And you wrote that they did try some limited price increases on luggage, housewares, and some furniture. Did they talk about when they did that and how they measured the response?
Well, those tariffs were instituted. I think they jumped to 25% up in May. And like I said, CEO Jeff Gennett said that just customers didn't have an appetite for those price increases. So going forward, especially when they institute the new tranche of tariffs, supposedly this December, they're going to try to work with vendors and partners to avoid having to raise any prices.
So should we expect to pay more, or is there any chance that they're going to be able to avoid this outright?
As long as the tariffs stay at 10%, Gennett said that, yes, customers should not see a price increase. But if they go up to 25%, he said it might be hard to avoid.
What is the long-term outlook for Macy's appear to be? I mean, a lot of us still miss the downtown location that shut down. Could other locations face that same fate without some improvements?
You know, I think they're really focusing on their core business, and they're trying some things that are a bit innovative for a department store, like their Backstage off-price concept. And they just announced partnerships with ThredUp and a new rental service that's coming to Bloomingdale's, which will inform what happens at Macy's. I don't know if we're in danger of seeing stores close down, but they did lower their earnings outlook for the whole year, and the tariffs are expected to hit that even harder.
You reported on Cincinnati Christian University. It's facing a loss of its accreditation. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, it could. It's one of the oldest institutions in Cincinnati, dating back to 1924. And back then, it was a Christian seminary. It used to train priests. And due to the rise of megachurches and the increase of non-denominational Christianity, they've strayed from that mission. They've, in 2015, started to restructure, becoming more of a liberal arts school. Their business is actually their biggest program right now. But that also left them with a bit of confusion about, you know, what precisely their mission is. So their accrediting body sent them a letter in July saying that if they don't put some things into place to kind of help define that mission and look at a couple of their programs, they could face loss of their accreditation.
How many students are we talking about here?
They have something in the mid-600s right now. So while they don't approach anywhere the level of UC, Xavier, or NKU, they still are a fairly decently sized college in Cincinnati.
Okay, so you also reported on Everything But the House. It's looking for a buyer. And of course, people use Everything But the House because they're looking for buyers for various wares that they're looking to get rid of. What could a sale of EBTH mean for those customers who use their service?
You know, I think in a perfect world, a sale would mean that business continues as usual. The buyer could keep the company operating. They could close it down and liquidate it or just use its assets. But the company wants the sellers to know that if they currently are listing on Everything But the House, their items and their money is safe. All proceeds from the sales are kept in escrow and released to the sellers. And then any items that are not sold at the point of EBTH being acquired will either be returned to the sellers or disposed of or sent to another consignment shop of the seller's choice.
Rivertown Brewing. Lawsuit. What's that?
Well, 13 lawsuits.
Oh.
And it kind of stems back to when they expanded to their current Monroe location. They took on a lot of contract brewing where they'd be the in-house brand for a lot of grocery stores. And to do that, they had to ramp up pretty quickly. That required taking out loans to buy new equipment. And their founder, Jason Roper, tells me that, you know, they had to rely on some new vendors that they hadn't used before. And unfortunately, they were given some goods that they allege were not up to snuff. And that caused them to lose some of these contracts. And that hit right at the same time as a government shutdown, meaning they couldn't put out new beers. So they had to shut down that contracting business, leaving some of these vendors who they allege sold them bad stuff unpaid.
Andy Brownfield from the Cincinnati Business Courier. Thanks for coming in and sharing some recaps of all those stories. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Are rideshare giants Uber and Lyft sustainable? Why does their price change minute to minute? The Friday News Review continues now with the rideshare guy, senior contributor and Los Angeles driver coach Sergio Avidian. Welcome, Sergio.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well. It's afternoon here in Cincinnati. Of course, you're in sunny Los Angeles where it is morning, so we appreciate you rising early and jumping on the phone with us. We had a little chat yesterday about this, and your perspective is very interesting. So we wanted to have you back on because news reports questioning the sustainability of apps like Lyft and Uber. Uber lost more than $5 billion last quarter. Lyft and the e-scooter Bird, for that matter, also lost money. What does all this tell us about the state of that industry?
Well, when it comes to rideshare, specifically Uber, obviously their last quarter was looked at as disastrous. But being an ex-Wall Street guy, that's what we call it, kitchen sink quarter. So basically what they did is they took all their losses related to their IPO and put it in that one quarter. So if you looked at, if you separated those losses from the actual earnings itself, well, they managed to only lose $1.3 billion. So about $4 billion of the $5.3 was cost related to their IPO. However, as we all know, Uber and Lyft have not made any money since they started the rideshare adventure of theirs. So it's been about 6-7 years in Lyft's case and about 8 years in Uber's case. Obviously, there's reasons for that. And if you'd like, I could go into those.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, initially, when Uber showed up, what their intent was to obviously increase the amount of riders on their platforms. So in order to do that, they subsidized pretty much every single ride by offering incentives to their drivers and to their riders. So the venture capitalists who initially invested in Uber and Lyft didn't mind doing that, looking at the longer-term picture. And at some point, I expected them to change course and raise prices. Well, what happened is that Lyft showed up about a year and a half after Uber came to market. So now there is a competitor. Now this becomes a commoditized business, basically. So they both decided, obviously, to, got into a race to the bottom, start lowering fares in order to increase ridership. And they have done an immense job about that, and they've done very good as far as growing their top line. Well, growing top line and ridership and revenue is what Wall Street is looking these days. We can tell VCs were throwing money at Uber and Lyft hand over fist. However, profitability is something else, and they haven't been able to achieve that. And I don't think going forward they're going to. In fact, if I was probably one of the handful of people who read their S-1, which is a document that they have to file with the SEC before their IPOs, I've read all 300 pages of both of theirs, and they say it in there themselves clearly that they may never be profitable. So we'll have to see where the chips fall going forward.
I wonder if this will be a situation like the early satellite radio wars where we had Sirius and XM, and now we just have Sirius XM. Are we possibly looking at an Uber-Lyft combo that could work at some point down the road?
Well, to be frank, actually, before Lyft even showed up, they were approached by Uber to get bought out. And Travis Kalanick, the CEO at the time, did not like the price that he was offered. So the reason for that was obviously to create a monopoly and have pricing power. But Lyft refrained from getting bought out and started competing with Uber and Lyft. And this is also a global phenomenon. It's not just in the U.S. You know, Lyft is only in the United States at the moment, and they're focusing on their growth story in the U.S. and only on rideshare. On the Uber side, Uber had some attempts in China and in India, and pretty much they were kicked out with massive losses out of China and India. Now, they do still have some presence. There are very, very strong competitors in Asia and Europe and South America. But Lyft just staying the course and just in one business, and which is rideshare, unlike Uber's case, which they're into now. Obviously, as everybody knows, Uber Eats, scooters, e-bikes. Now they're getting into the transportation business by Uber Freight. So it seems like Uber has more pans on the fire as opposed to Lyft. But, diverging business models, and we'll have to find out which one is going to have more success going forward.
From a customer's perspective, what's the difference between Uber and Lyft?
Well, first of all, I'm also a driver on both platforms. I've been a driver for the last probably close to 4 years with about 6,000 rides under my belt. And I'm also a passenger. I'm also a customer. So I use them quite frequently when I go out at night or to run some errands, whatever it is that I need to do. To be honest with you, as far as the customer is concerned, there isn't much. The concern of the passengers so far has always been, you know, get from point A to point B safely and for the lowest price, pretty much. Now, there were some issues in the past when Mr. Kalanick, the ex-CEO of Uber, joined President Trump's Economic Council, and there was a movement called Delete Uber, and they ended up losing close to 200,000-300,000 passengers. Some passengers look at Lyft as more politically correct company, more kinder, gentler company. But as far as pricing is concerned and what the goal of the passenger is, which is to get from point A to point B safely, there isn't really that much of a difference.
Do we expect to see similar economic concerns for the fortunes of these food delivery services that even some of these rideshare groups are part of, you know, like DoorDash or Uber Eats?
Well, that's a massive industry on its own, and Uber has obviously taken the lead as far as one of the rideshare companies to get into it. But obviously, we have Grubhub, we have DoorDash, we have Caviar, who was just bought by DoorDash for about $500 million a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, there's a lot of competition in business. I mean, wherever there is competition, as far as I have an economics background and economics degree, so wherever there's that much intense competition, pricing power obviously is not there. So as far as these companies making money, you know, valuations is one thing. Profitability is something else. Yes, we do have massive valuations, but then what are they based on? Are they based on profitability down the line, maybe in a couple, 3 years? But what's going to, in my mind, what's going to happen, which is happening also with the scooter companies, as you mentioned before, none of them are profitable. So I expect massive consolidation going forward. And then maybe they will have some sort of pricing power and something start raising fares or delivery prices.
Well, speaking of raising fares, when you and I chatted yesterday, you noted something very interesting that I didn't know about. Now, I know that the price of one of these ride shares can fluctuate depending on the time of day and the frequency of use among the users overall. But you're saying that the prices can fluctuate for an individual user within mere seconds of making a request. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, yes, the price will fluctuate. I mean, I invite all the passengers. I do it all the time myself when I'm ordering rides and take screenshots about it. The price difference is not immense. Unless at the time you're ordering a ride, the demand is so high that they Uber institute something called surge pricing, which is a multiplier. And in Lyft's case, it's called prime time, which is also a multiplier. So, you know, the business is obviously supply-demand driven, and algorithms decide when to put the surge on for other drivers to come into the area and to, you know, to clear that demand. So about a year and a half ago, Uber instituted something called upfront pricing. When Uber first started, you would get charged by miles and minutes, basically just like a cab. And then Uber would take 20 or 25%, depending how long you've been driving, out of that fare and give the rest to the passenger. Well, they have figured out this upfront pricing scheme, which is your fare has pretty much nothing to do with miles and minutes any longer. So you could go to your passenger app and order a ride, and then you do it again 30 seconds later and again a minute later. All these fares are going to be different. Now, I'm not saying they're going to be drastically different unless right before you order your ride, surge has kicked in. But assuming it's a base ride, base meaning no surge, no prime time involved, the rides will always be priced differently, 50 cents, a dollar, a couple of dollars here and there. And that's the extra money that Uber and Lyft are going to keep. They're not going to pass that on to the passenger. And it's, they call it dynamic pricing. Dynamic meaning it's changing all the time. So for a passenger, my suggestion would be, well, you know, just price your ride a couple, three times on both platforms, and then you'll see the difference. And obviously to the passenger, it's not going to mean much. 50 cents a dollar, nobody pays attention. They still order the rides because Uber and Lyft have become synonymous with transportation, basically. It's like Starbucks. So what they do is they go order it. However, if you consider that between Uber and Lyft, there's close to 10 million rides a day done in the United States alone, well, that's major money, right? So even if it's 50 cents a ride, that's $5 million a day. So that's what they're doing. And I encourage all passengers to test this out themselves.
You can read Sergio Avidian's writings on this topic at The Rideshare Guy. You can search that online and find that. Sergio, we really appreciate your time. Hope to talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, here at WVXU, the AC was off today, and it was very hot inside the building. And this is just days after the power went out, and we were in the dark. Here to give us the very latest on our very own building is WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. What's going on in this place?
They didn't tell me anything about that.
No, the AC's back on. We're calm, cool, and collected. But what's hot is Kings Island. Biggest announcement in their 47-year history.
That's what they're saying.
What's going on out there?
Well, we're getting a new roller coaster. So if that's what, you know, gets you excited, gets you going, is a huge drop, you are in luck because it's going to be the 7th giga coaster in the world.
Okay. I keep hearing this like here in our station, on all the radio stations, all the TVs, they're like, it's a giga coaster.
Right.
And I love roller coasters, but I don't know that term.
Yeah. I mean, I've only really heard it recently and when they were, well, not recently, but since they've been talking about, oh, a roller coaster is going to come, a giga coaster. Basically, giga coasters go really high and really fast. The only thing that's bigger is a Stratacoaster, which is above 400 feet. So there's only seven, well, once this one's built, there'll be 7 giga coasters in the world. They're between 300 and 399 feet tall, and they get their thrill from this airtime, you know, from huge drops, really fast, not inversions. So there's no loops in this giga coaster.
It's all about the big drop.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So this was really hyped up by Kings Island. And we know their PR people are good at hyping something up that, you know, is either interesting or isn't, depending on
your level
of interest in amusement parks.
Yeah. But like the people are so excited about these things, you know, and then of course the media is looking, you know, pulling into that hype, looking at files that have been records, you know, plans and everything. So actually the PR guy said to me last night, Chad Showalter, there's just so little left to protect, you know, that people didn't already figure out. So
what did you tell me? Like, this, I may have missed this. What's the name of this?
It's called Orion.
Orion.
It has a bit of a space sort of theme. They showed, you know, a meteor crashing into Kings Island. And so the whole Project X thing, they're going to rename the area where it's going to be built Area 72 after 1972 when the park opened. But, you know, the theme is that scientists have been secretly testing the effects of flight on humans for years in this area.
Very clever. Did they say how much this is costing?
Well, they will just say more than $30 million. But sort of the fun fact there is that this is more than what the park cost to build.
Oh, my gosh.
When it opened in the 70s.
Oh, my God. Do you like roller coasters?
Well, you know, I do. It's harder to ride them now as I've gotten older. You get off and you're like, oh my gosh, my head's a little bit. But I think this one will be smooth. You know, Mystic Timbers opened a couple years ago and it was really smooth. I rode that. And so, you know, if they have a media day where they invite us out, I'm going to take a ride.
Yeah, I'm going to watch you do that for sure. Tana Weingartner from WVXU, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reader. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.